So sit back, relax, and enjoy yourselves here with some spoken word entertainment on CITR 101.9 FM.
What newspapers and magazines did you regularly read to stay informed and to understand the
I've
world?
Read most of them, again, with a great appreciation for the press, for the media.
But like, what ones specifically?
All of them.
Want to know more than Sarah Palin? Join CITR's Current Affairs Coordinator Alex DeBoer every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. in room 2514 in the AMS Nest to learn best practices for covering local current affairs topics for radio. The weekly training sessions will cover writing for radio, determining newsworthiness, media ethics, interviewing, writing balanced stories, and more.
Tonight, we take pleasure in bringing you Suspense, a weekly anthology of notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense.
Fenistone Road, Clapham, August the 20th, 1945. I have had what I believe may turn out to be the most remarkable day of my life. And while I still have the chance, I wish to record the sequence of events as clearly as possible. My name is James Clarence Withencroft. You must remember that in order to have the full implication of my story. James Clarence Withencroft. I am 40 years old, in perfect health, never having known a day's illness. By profession, I am an artist. Not a very successful one, to be sure, but I earn enough money by my black and white work to satisfy my necessary wants. My only near relative, a sister, died 5 years ago. So there is no one in particular to whom I address this manuscript. Only you, who might, by chance, read it someday. For because of the peculiar circumstance about which you will soon hear, I have the unshakable feeling that I shall never live to tell anyone about it. I breakfasted this morning at 9, my usual time, and went about my usual routine. After glancing through the morning paper, I began to let my mind wander, in the hope that I might chance upon some subject for my pencil. The room, even with both door and window open, was oppressively hot. I had just made up my mind that the coolest and most comfortable place in the whole neighborhood would be the deep end of the public swimming pool, when I was suddenly shaken. A feeling swept over me such as I had never experienced before. I attempted to rise to my feet, but somehow it seemed as though I had suddenly been fastened to my chair. My hand went out in an effort to brace myself, and then, before I knew what I was doing, my pencil was in my hand, and I began to draw. It was as though someone had taken my hand and was moving it across the paper, swiftly in bold strokes. And then, just as suddenly, I seemed to take over. My hand, back under its own power, began to draw. I soon forgot the oppressive heat. Everything was forgotten, except for the frantic feeling that the sketch must be finished as soon as possible. I had no idea how long I worked until I heard the clock of St. Jude's in the distance. It was 4 o'clock, and I had just started after breakfast. Now, for the first time since I'd begun, I actually seemed to see what I had been sketching. I was surprised. The final result was, I felt sure, the best thing I'd ever done. It showed a criminal in the dock, immediately after the judge had pronounced sentence. The man was fat, enormously fat. The flesh hung in rolls about his chin. It creased his huge, stumpy neck. He was clean-shaven, or perhaps I should say, a few days before he must have been clean-shaven, and he was almost bald. He stood there before the judge, his short, clumsy fingers clasping the rail, looking straight in front of him. The feeling that his expression conveyed was not so much one of horror as utter, absolute collapse. There seemed nothing in the man strong enough to sustain that mountain of flesh. And then I saw that the sketch wasn't complete. For the man's other hand seemed to be clutching an instrument of some kind, a weapon, but it hadn't been completed. I had made this sketch, yet I had no recollection of what I'd intended the man to carry in his other hand. I took up my pencil again and attempted to fill in the fuzzy outline, but it was useless. It was as though my fingers had suddenly turned to lead. I sat down, and I felt the moisture slowly forming on my forehead. And, once again, I was conscious of the blazing, oppressive heat. Then I knew that there would be no finishing of this sketch, at any rate not for the moment. So I rolled it up and put it in my pocket, anxious to show the sketch to my friend Trenton. For in spite of my peculiar inspiration, I was filled with the rare sense of happiness which the knowledge of a good thing well done gives. I walked along Lytton Street and then turned right along Gilchrist Road at the bottom of the hill, where the men are at work on the new tram lines. But from there onward, I have only the vaguest recollection of where I went. Through parks, along crowded streets, and always conscious of the awful heat that came up from the dusty asphalt pavement in a suffocating wave. And I remember, too, the hollow sound of my footsteps as I moved along. Although now walking aimlessly, I somehow knew there was a goal, a something to which I was drawn. I longed for the thunder promised by the great banks of copper-colored clouds that hung low over the western sky.
Say, do you have the time, mister?
Mm. Oh, 20 minutes to 7.
Thanks. Hot enough for you, sir?
Mm. Oh, yes.
Hottest August on record so far.
Yes. Has it been good for your business?
Oh, you'd think so, right? But it's so hot out that even the kids don't want to come out.
Ah, well, perhaps it will cool off once those thunderstorms pass through, eh?
I sure hope so. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. As he left, I took stock of my bearings. I found myself standing before a gate that led into a yard bordered by a strip of thirsty earth. There were flowers, purple stock and scarlet geranium, and great numbers of bees droned over them. Over the entrance was a board with the inscription, Charles Atkinson, Monumental Mason/Worker in English and Italian Marbles. From the yard itself came a cheery whistle, the noise of hammer blows and the cold sound of steel meeting stone. A sudden impulse made me enter, and I went in the direction of the noise. There was a man sitting with his back towards me. He was busy at work on a slab of curiously veined marble. Then, without turning, his hammer stopped in midair, as he was about to bring it down on his chisel. He held this position a moment before turning, but I knew that he was aware of my presence, and when he turned, I saw his face. It was the face of the man I had been drawing. Yes, it was the face of the man whose sketch was in my pocket. He sat there on his low stool, huge and elephantine, the sweat pouring from his scalp, not speaking. Then he took a red silk handkerchief from his pocket and mopped his brow. Whew. Although the face that looked up at me was the same as my sketch, the expression was absolutely different. Suddenly, the puzzled expression left his face, and he smiled as if we were old friends. He walked over and shook my hand.
Good day, sir.
Good day. I'm sorry to intrude.
No, not at all.
Everything is so hot and glary outside. This is like an oasis in the desert.
I don't know about an oasis, but it certainly is art. Oh, please, take a seat, sir.
He pointed to the end of the gravestone on which he was at work, and I sat down.
Ah, very art.
Yes, indeed it is. That's a beautiful piece of stone you're working on.
It is, in a way. The surface here is as fine as anything you could wish for. But there's a big flaw at the back, though I don't expect you'd notice it.
Oh, I shouldn't think so.
I could never really do a good job on a bit of marble like that. It would be all right in the summer like this. It wouldn't mind the blasted heat, but wait until the winter comes.
But winter?
There's nothing quite like frost to find out the weak points in stone.
Oh.
A gravestone, you see?
Oh, I see. Well, then, what's this one for?
Huh? Oh, you'd hardly believe me if I was to tell you, but it's for exhibition.
Exhibition?
Oh, it's the truth. After all, artists have exhibitions, so do grocers and butchers, and, well, we have them too. All the latest little things in headstones, you know.
He went on to talk of marbles, which sort of marble best withstood wind and rain, and which were easiest to work. Then of his garden and some new carnation he had bought. At the end of every other minute, he would drop his tools and wipe his shining head.
This heat's bad. A man's not responsible for what he does in this heat.
I said little, for I felt uneasy. There was something unnatural, uncanny in all of this. The feeling that I'd experienced it all before, the oppressive heat, the fragrance of the stocks in the air, the conversation about the marble, the flowers, everything. As though I had experienced it before. And yet I knew that I'd never, ever been in this section of town before. I tried to persuade myself that at least I'd seen him before. That his face, which I had thought to be unknown to me, had found a place in some out-of-the-way corner of my memory. But I knew that I was practicing little more than a plausible piece of self-deception.
There. What do you think of that?
He said it with an air of evident pride in a job well done. I could sense that he was experiencing the same feeling I had experienced when I'd finished my sketch. Then he got up with a sigh of relief.
Hot. Hot, ain't it?
I was seated in such a position that I was unable to see his work. And for some reason, I didn't move.
In the midst of life, we are in death. Born January 18th, 1905.
I looked up with a start. The man had just read my exact birth date.
He passed away very suddenly on August 20th, 1945.
That's today.
Oh, well, we usually use the present date on these exhibition stones.
Do you usually put a name on them, too?
Oh, yes. Sacred to the memory of James Clarence Withencroft. Whew. Hot. Hot.
Where did you see that name?
Oh, I didn't see it anywhere. I wanted some name, and I put down the first that came into my head.
Well, it's a strange coincidence, but that happens to be my name.
That's your name? You're, James Clarence,
Withencroft, yes.
The dates?
Well, I can only answer for the birth date, but it's correct.
That's a rum go.
And it gets stranger still. I made a sketch this morning. Of you.
Of me? But you've never seen me before.
No, I haven't.
Oh.
I took the sketch from my pocket and showed it to him. As he looked, the expression on his face altered until it became more and more like that of the man I had drawn.
And it was only the other day I told Mariah there were no such things as ghosts.
I know what you mean. Well, there's probably a reasonable explanation. You probably heard my name someplace.
Yes, and you must have seen me somewhere and then had forgotten.
Yes, of course, that must be it.
Were you at Clacton-on-Sea last July?
No, I've never been to Clacton in my life.
Oh.
We were once again silent for some time. We just stood there, looking at one another and at the two dates on the gravestone. The birth one was right, and the other was today.
Well, come inside and have some supper, will you? We'll think this thing through. Mariah, we have company for supper. Mariah, this is Mr. Withencroft.
Hello, Mr. Withencroft.
Pleased to make your acquaintance, Mrs. Atkinson. I do hope I'm not intruding.
Oh, not at all. You are welcome in my home.
Mr. Withencroft is a friend of mine.
Well, I'm just sorry Charles has not brought you here before.
Oh, no, it's not his fault. I don't often get over to this part of town.
Mr. Withencroft is an artist, Mariah.
An artist, you say? How interesting. I've never known an artist before.
Well, your husband has quite the artistic flair himself. We were just admiring his handiwork on an exhibition tombstone.
Oh, I suppose you're right, Mr. Withencroft. What is your specialty?
I'm a painter, Mrs. Atkinson.
Oh, please, call me Mariah.
Oh, yes, of course, Mariah. I'm a painter, but mostly I do black and white sketchwork.
How splendid. I would very much like to see some of your work. Is that one of your sketches sticking out of your pocket?
No, it's not yet finished.
Oh, well, perhaps some other time. Why don't you sit down? Supper will be ready presently.
Little was said during the meal, but after the sardines and watercress had been removed, Mariah walked over to a cupboard and took down a thin black book, and as she placed it in front of me, she spoke.
You have a most pleasing voice, Mr. Withencroft. Would you please read aloud?
Puzzled, I looked down at the book, which she'd opened to a particular page. It was a very tiny book. The Prophet, it was called, by an author unknown to me, with a strange Eastern name, Khalil Gibran. Then my eyes fell across the page, and suddenly I was reading aloud, as she'd asked me to do. But if in your fear you would seek only love's peace and love's pleasure, Then it is better for you that you cover your nakedness and pass out of love's threshing floor into the seasonless world where you shall laugh, but not all of your laughter, and weep, but not all of your tears. Love gives naught but itself, and takes naught but from itself. When I looked up, Mr. Atkinson had gone, but his wife stood before me, and as she took the book, she spoke.
Thank you.
Then I went outside, where I found Atkinson sitting on the gravestone and smoking. He looked up at me.
Heart. Heart. A man's not responsible for what he might do in this heat. She never asked anyone to read aloud before.
No, it's probably just because I have such a dull tone to my voice. Better than a sleeping pill to set one off down the road to slumber.
No, that's not it. Let's have a look at that sketch again, shall we? Likeness is me, all right. On trial.
You must excuse my asking, but... do you know of anything you've done for which you could be put on trial?
No, I've done nothing. At least not yet. should water the flowers while I'm thinking about it. Twice a day regular in hot weather, and then the heat sometimes still gets the better of the delicate ones. And ferns, oh good Lord, they could never stand it. Where do you live?
All the way on the other side of town. It must be at least an hour's quick walk.
It's like this. We'll look at the matter straight. If you go home tonight, you take your chance of accidents. A cop may run over you. There's always banana skins and orange peels, to say nothing of falling ladders.
He spoke of the improbable with an intense seriousness that would have been laughable 6 hours before, but I did not laugh.
No, the best thing we can do is for you to stay here till 12 o'clock. Then it'll be tomorrow, do you see?
Well...
We'll go upstairs and smoke. It may be cooler inside. Come on.
To my great surprise, I agreed. Sitting in a long, low room beneath the eaves. The heat here is even more intense, almost overwhelming. Atkinson's wife has gone to bed, while he himself is busy sharpening some tools at a little oilstone, smoking one of my cigars as he works. And as I look at the sketch before me, I suddenly see the fuzzy outline of what the man in the picture holds in his hand. For while I had not been able to sketch it before, I am able to do so now. It is a chisel, and it is stained with blood. The air seems charged with thunder, and I hear it in the distance. It is ominous, but it carries the hope of rain. And perhaps this damnable heat will be broken soon, and the day will soon be over. It is close to 12. I am writing this at a shaky table before the open window. The leg is cracked, and Atkinson, who seems a handy man with his tools, is going to mend it as soon as he has finished putting an edge on his chisel. Any moment now, it will be 12. The day will be over, and I shall be going home. But the heat is stifling. I feel as if I can't stay here another moment. The heat, it's enough to... A man's not responsible for what he does in this heat.
So ends August Heat by John C. Alzadek and Dana Perry Hayes. Tonight's story of suspense. Suspense is produced by Blue Hours Productions and recorded at Melrose Music in Hollywood, California. Tonight's radio drama was adapted for radio by John C. Alzadek and Dana Perry Hayes from the short story by W.F. Harvey. Talon Beeson was James Clarence Withencroft. Damon Krall was Charles Atkinson. Susan Eisenberg was Mariah Atkinson. And Matt Frazier was the ice cream vendor. I'm your host, Damon Krall. Next week at this time, tune in again for another study in suspense.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband, Tom, and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it.
So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
Is Coco Hamamatsu talking about koi fish in a pond or the youth at CITR and Discorder? Get info on your wares, services, or events directly to students, musicians, artists, and all the coolest cats from Bellingham to Squamish by advertising with CITR and Discorder on air, in print, or online. This can be your reality if you email us at advertising@citr.ca or call 604-822-4342. Visit CITR.ca for rates and packages.
Tonight, we take pleasure in bringing you Suspense, a weekly anthology of notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio. Presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense.
I'd been out of work for several months, and my savings were perilously near the vanishing point. Therefore, I was naturally elated when I received from John Carnby a favorable answer inviting me to present my qualifications in person. Carnby had advertised for a secretary and had specified his requirements fully and succinctly. His requirements were of such nature as to bar even the average well-educated person with knowledge of Arabic foremost among his needs. Luckily, I had acquired a certain degree of scholarship in that unusual tongue, and so it came to pass that I found myself at Carnby's home, atop a hill in the suburbs of Oakland. It was a large two-story house, overshaded by ancient oaks and dark with a mantling of unchecked ivy, among hedges of unpruned privet and shrubbery that had gone wild for many years. It was separated from its neighbors by a vacant, weed-grown lot on one side, and a tangle of vines and trees on the other.
Yes?
Mr. Carnby, I'm Stephen Ogden. We spoke earlier about the secretarial position.
Of course. Please, come in, Mr. Ogden. You may put your bags down here in the entryway.
Thank you, sir.
Your resume is quite impressive, as is your fluency in literary Arabic. How are you in the classical form?
My initial studies were in classical Arabic, Mr. Carnby, so I'm actually more comfortable with it than with the modern form.
You are well acquainted with the works of al-Baladuri?
With his Kitab Ansab al-Ashraf, of course.
And you have read the Mugaddimah, yes?
Ibn Khaldun is a particular favorite of mine, as is Ibn Battuta. In fact, I have works by both of them in my bags downstairs.
I think you will do, Mr. Ogden. Your labors will not be very heavy, but I want someone who can be on hand at any time required. Therefore, you must live with me. I can give you a comfortable room, and I guarantee that my cooking will not poison you. I often work at night, and I hope you will not find the irregular hours too disagreeable.
That will be fine, Mr. Carnby. When shall I start?
You will start immediately. This very afternoon, if possible.
How about right now? I have my reference materials with me, should they be needed.
That would be most acceptable. I shall be very glad to have you here, Mr. Ogden. I have been living entirely alone for some time, and I must confess that the solitude is beginning to pall upon me. Also, I have been retarded in my labors for lack of the proper help. My brother, Hellman, used to live with me and assist in my researches, but he has gone away on a long trip. This is my study.
Good Lord. My apologies, sir.
I imagine my study isn't quite what you were expecting.
That would be quite an understatement, Mr. Carnby.
I have made a life study of demonism and sorcery. It is a fascinating field, and one that is singularly neglected.
Well, your study would be the envy of any medieval sorcerer. Archaic instruments, astrological charts, skeletons of various animals, artwork of a distinctly supernatural aspect, even magical symbols drawn on the floorboards. And this collection of books, it's immense. All manner of volumes on demonology, witch cults, and the black arts.
I am now preparing a monograph in which I am trying to correlate the magical practices and demon worship of every known age and people. Your labors, at least for a while, will consist in typing and arranging the voluminous preliminary notes which I have made, and in helping me to track down other references and correspondences. Your knowledge of Arabic will be invaluable to me, for I am none too proficient in the language myself, and I am depending for certain essential data on a copy of the Al-Hazif, that ancient Arabic text that was to later become most infamously known as the Necronomicon.
The Necronomicon? I'm not especially well-versed in magical lore, but even I have heard of it. The Necronomicon is supposed to contain the ultimate secrets of evil and forbidden knowledge, isn't it?
It is. The spells, incantations, and descriptions contained within were potent enough that the author, the mad Arab Abd al-Hazred, was reportedly devoured horribly in broad daylight by some invisible monster.
And you have the original Arabic translation? It's thought to be no longer in existence.
I'll show you the volume after dinner. You will doubtless be able to elucidate one or two passages that have long puzzled me.
Puzzled? In what way, sir?
I have reason to think that there are certain omissions and erroneous renderings in the Latin version of Ullus Vermius, which I have been using in certain researches. However, that will wait until later. In the meantime, I have some notes that I wish to have typed.
The evening meal, prepared and served by my employer himself, was a welcome change from the cheap restaurant fare to which I was accustomed. Carnby seemed to have lost a good deal of his nervousness. In fact, he was very talkative and even began to exhibit a certain scholarly gaiety after we had shared a bottle of mellow Sauterne. Still, with no manifest reason, I was troubled by intimations and forebodings which I could neither analyze nor trace to their rightful source. Those feelings were only exacerbated when we returned to the study.
Please sit down while I fetch the Necronomicon.
Excellent. ebony covers. Arabesque with silver and set in garnets. Must be enormously old.
Indeed. But the stench that permeates these ancient pages is not due simply to age. It is the odor of physical decay.
As if it had lain among corpses in some forgotten graveyard for centuries and had taken on the taint of disillusion.
That may be a more accurate description than you realize. Here, tell me what you make of this.
All right. It is verily known by few, but is nevertheless no less attestable fact that the will of a dead sorcerer hath power over his own body and can raise it up from the tomb to perform therewith whatever action was unfulfilled in life. Such resurrections are invariably for the doing of malevolent deeds and for the detriment of others. Most readily can the corpse be animated if all its members have remained intact. Yet there are cases in which the excelling will of the wizard hath reared up from death the sundered pieces of a body, hewn in many fragments, and hath caused them to serve his end, either separately or in a temporary reunion. But in every instance, after the action hath been completed, the body doth lapse into its former state. What was that?
The house is full of rats. I have never been able to get rid of them, despite all my efforts.
Now, Mr. Carnby, are you all right? You seem quite disturbed.
I am very nervous. I have worked too hard lately, and this is the result. Even a little noise upsets me.
Well, they seem to be retreating.
For the moment. About the translation, that is a most remarkable passage. I was doubtful about its meaning, given my imperfect Arabic, and I have found that the passage is wholly omitted in the Latin version by Olaus Vermius. Thank you for your scholarly rendering. You have certainly cleared it up for me.
Of course, Mr. Carnby.
And now, I should like you to translate another passage. However, no need to read this one aloud. Just write it down, if you please.
Well, it appears to be some sort of incantatory formula for the exorcism of the dead. It involves the use of rare Arabian spices and the proper intoning of the names of certain ghouls and demons.
It is. And this, too, is not in the Vermius edition.
Well, that should be it, then.
Very good. Now, if you will examine this page.
That evening was one of the strangest I have ever spent. As we sat for hour upon hour discussing renditions from that unhallowed volume, I came to know more and more definitely that my employer was mortally afraid of something, and that he dreaded being alone, and was keeping me with him on this account. Always he seemed to be listening with a painful, tortured expectation.
I fear that I have kept you up too long. You must go and get some sleep. I'm selfish, and I forget that such hours are not habitual to others as they are to me.
Oh, it's not that late, Mr. Carnby.
Nonsense. You were barely able to keep your eyes open. Please, take your leave. Good night.
Good night, sir. So dark in this hallway. Better watch my step. What was that? What the devil? Something's there. I can't tell what it is, but I know this much. It's much too pale to be a rat. And its form is not at all suggestive of any animal. That night, I slept a deep and dreamless sleep and did not awaken until 10 o'clock the next morning. Wondering whether my employer had left me undisturbed through thoughtfulness or had not yet arisen himself, I dressed and went downstairs to find him waiting at the breakfast table. He was paler and more tremulous than ever, as if he had slept little and badly.
Good morning, Mr. Ogden.
Good morning, sir.
Did you sleep well?
I did, thank you. My apologies for being so late to rise. I don't normally sleep past 7 a.m. I hope I haven't detained you.
Think nothing of it. I've only just arisen myself, not more than 20 minutes ago. I do hope the rats didn't annoy you too much. Something really must be done about them.
I didn't notice them at all.
Can I offer you some breakfast?
No, thank you. This coffee will be fine for now.
So, you didn't see or hear anything unusual?
No. Nothing.
Are you quite certain?
Quite.
Excellent. If you will excuse me, I have a private matter to attend to. I shall be indisposed until late in the afternoon, and am not to be disturbed under any circumstances. Is that understood?
Yes, of course, Mr. Carnby.
I shall have need of you later this afternoon and all evening. In the meantime, you are free to do whatever you wish, provided that you do not leave the house. I highly recommend the library downstairs. You shall find it quite impressive for a private collection.
That sounds like an excellent idea, sir. Thank you.
Until later.
Until later. Just what Carnby was doing alone in that room for much of the day, I could not be certain. But more than once, I thought I heard that awesome formula that I had translated for Carnby being read in his sepulchral tones. Despite my best efforts to occupy myself in this well-appointed, albeit quite conventional, library, horror-breeding hints and noisome intuitions invaded my brain. More and more, the atmosphere of the house enveloped me, stifled me with poisonous, miasmal mystery. So it was almost a relief when my employer summoned me to his study. Been doing a bit of redecorating, Mr. Carnby.
Why do you say that?
That Isfahan rug, it had been near the wall, but now it's at the center of the room, covering the floorboards upon which your magical symbols are drawn. And that smell, it's quite aromatic. Arabian gums and spices, aren't they? Such as the ones described in the passage I translated for you.
I have some detailed notes I wish you to type for me, Mr. Ogden. Related mainly to formula for the acquisition of unlawful power.
Unlawful power, sir?
Around 7 o'clock, we shall have supper and then return to work. It may be a very late evening. Are you feeling sufficiently rested?
Oh, yes, sir. A late evening will be no trouble at all.
Good. Then let's get to work, shall we?
Evening came, and after our meal, we returned again to the study. There was a tenseness in Carnby's manner now, as if he was eagerly awaiting the result of some unknown test. I went on with my work, but some of his emotion communicated itself to me, and ever and anon I caught myself in an attitude of strained listening. Do you hear that? Mr. Carnby, did you hear that? From the expression on your face, you hear it, all right.
I hear it.
Then tell me, what is all this racket? It's getting louder by the moment.
The rats, I tell you, it is only the rats.
Rats? Are you mad? That cacophony of sound is more than even the biggest of rats could make.
Don't open that!
Good God!
You saw?
It was a human hand severed at the wrist. A bony, bluish hand like that of a week-old corpse with garden mold on the fingers and under the nails. But the damnable thing was moving! And it wasn't alone. There were other body parts, a foot, a part of a leg, and a forearm, moving away slowly, flopping and wriggling hideously in a charnel procession. In heaven's name, what does it mean?
He is stronger than I am. Even in death, even with his body dismembered by the surgeon's knife and saw that I used, I thought he could not return after that. After I had buried the portions in a dozen different places in the cellar, beneath the shrubs at the foot of the ivy vines. But the Necronomicon is right, and my brother Helba knew it. He warned me before I killed him. He told me he could return, even in that condition. But I did not believe him. I hated Hellman, and he hated me too. He had attained a higher degree of power and knowledge, was more favored by the Dark Ones than I. That is why I killed him. My own twin brother. My brother in the service of Satan, and of those who were before Satan. We had studied together for many years. We had celebrated the Black Mass together, and we were attended by the same familiars. But Hellman Carnby had gone deeper into the occult. Into the forbidden, where I could not follow him. I feared him, and I could not endure his supremacy. It has been 10 days since I did the deed, but Hellman, or some part of him, has returned every night. Dear God, his accursed hands crawling on the floor, his feet, his arms, the segments of his legs climbing the stairs in some unmentionable way to haunt me. His awful bloody torso, laying in wait. I tell you, his hands have come even by day to tap and fumble at my door. And I have stumbled over his arms in the dark. Merciful heavens, I shall go mad with the awfulness of it. But he wants me to go mad. He wants to torture me till my brain gives way. That is why he haunts me in this piecemeal fashion. He could end it all at any time. The demoniacal power that is his. He could reknit his sundered limbs and body and slay me as I slew him. How carefully I buried the parts. With what infinite forethought. And how useless it was. I buried the saw and knife, too, at the farther end of the garden, as far away as possible from his evil, twitching hands. But I did not bury the head with the other pieces. I kept it in that locked cupboard at the end of the room. But he does not need the head. His will is elsewhere and can work intelligently through all his members. Of course, I locked all the doors and windows at night when I found that he was coming back. But it made no difference. And I have tried to exorcise him with the appropriate incantations, with all those that I knew. Today, I tried that sovereign formula from the Necronomicon which you translated for me. It was why I hired you. I got you here to translate it. That, and I could no longer bear to be alone here. And I thought it might help if there was someone else in the house. That formula was my last hope. I thought it would hold him. It is a most ancient and most dreadful incantation. But, as you have seen, it is useless. Are you leaving? Don't go!
Yes, I'm going. I'm resigning my position right now, and I intend to pack my belongings and leave this house with as little delay as possible.
Please, wait! I'll double your salary. Triple! Name your price!
Mr. Carnby, there is no amount of money that could convince me to spend another moment in this house. I should prefer to face whatever might lurk in that hallway, no matter how loathsome or terrifying, rather than endure any longer the society of one capable of so monstrous an act.
No!
The hall was empty, but as I hastened to my room, I shuddered with repulsion at the memory of what I had just seen. I think I should have screamed aloud at the least sound or movement in the shadows. I began to pack my valise with a feeling of the most frantic urgency and compulsion. It seemed to me that I could not escape soon enough from that house of abominable secrets, over which hung an atmosphere of smothering menace. Those footsteps. Carnby locked himself in his study. And anyway, those aren't his footfalls. Dear God, no. It couldn't be.
No! Stay back!
I should do something. I must. But I cannot. I feel powerless to move. Heaven help me. That sound. What is that sound? Dare I look? I must know. The study door, shattered. Upon discovering the source of that unnerving sound, I fell into a dead faint, and understandably so, given what I had seen. For as I peered into the room, I saw the gruesome outline of a monstrous, awkwardly moving shadow on the Isfahan rug. Horrified, I nonetheless crossed over the sill and entered the room. And that's when I saw the source of the shadow. Huge, elongated, misshapen, the shadow was cast by the arms and torso of a naked man who stooped forward with a surgeon's saw in his hand. There was an overall air of rot, decay about him, and yet this was not the true monstrosity. Its monstrosity lay in this. Though the shoulders, chest, abdomen, and arms were all clearly distinguishable, the shadow was headless and appeared to terminate in an abruptly severed neck. It was impossible, considering the relative position, for the head to have been concealed from sight through any manner of foreshortening. It simply was not there. As I regained consciousness, I imagined that nothing could be more dreadful. That imagining, however, proved to be horrifyingly wrong. Upon the floorboards lay a double heap of human segments, mingled in abhorrent confusion. Some of them fresh and bloody, others already blue with beginning putrefaction and marked with dirt and mold. A reddened knife and saw were protruding from the pile, and a little to one side, between the rug and the previously locked cupboard, its door now shattered, there reposed a human head that was fronting the other remnants in an upright posture. It was in the same condition of incipient decay as the body to which it had belonged, but I swear that I saw the fading of a malignant exultation from its features as I entered. Even with the marks of corruption upon them, the lineaments bore a manifest likeness of John Carnby. For they could belong only to a twin brother.
So ends The Return of the Sorcerer by John C. Alzadek and Dana Perry Hayes. Tonight's story of Suspense. Suspense is produced by Blue Hours Productions. Tonight's radio drama was adapted by John C. Alzadek and Dana Perry Hayes from the short story by Clark Ashton Smith. Tucker Smallwood was John Carnby, and Ron Botita was Stephen Ogden. I'm Damon Crawl. Next week at this time, tune in again for another study in Suspense.
Full force. This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Loading Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
And you are tuned into CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Brian McDonald, and that's all the time that we have tonight for Scald's Hall. Coming up in a moment, we're going to have Canada Post Rock with John. So from all of us here in Vancouver, please have a safe